Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday, August 6th. I've got 66 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City. Heber City reporting 66 degrees as well. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Hope your Tuesday is off to a great start. And I'll tell you what, we are starting off calm. As you mentioned, those temperatures in the 60s, not too bad out there in the Heber Valley and Park City. But as we go throughout the day, oh, the heat is going to be on. We're likely looking at the hottest day of the week happening today. So that's one way to look at it, at least. It can't get any hotter than today for the rest of the week. We're looking at highs in the lower 90s around Park City as we go throughout this afternoon. Highs will be in the upper 90s and probably right around 100 or so in the Heber Valley. So make sure you're taking your heat precautions once again today. That means staying hydrated, drinking plenty of fluids, primarily water, and replacing those electrolytes as well, especially if you're working outside and will be sweating throughout the day. And remember, don't wait till you're thirsty to start hydrating, because once you're already thirsty, it's already too late out there. So keep that in mind. Otherwise, as we go into the rest of this week, we're going to deal with some partly cloudy skies. We should dry things out for our Wednesday and Thursday, but then we'll notice temperatures starting to decrease a little bit by your Friday into Saturday, but rain chances may actually return a little bit across the area. So we're going to bring back the chance of isolated showers and storms by the end of the week, and temperatures cooling back down into the 80s and lower 90s across portions of the region from Park City down towards the Heber Valley area. And then into the weekend, I think most of us may drop down into the 80s, and Park City may not even get out of the 70s by the end of the weekend. And that's because we're going to be introducing a pretty good chance of some scattered showers and thunderstorms and some cool air finally making its way back into the area. So we may be talking about some below normal temperatures sneaking back into the region. But for this afternoon, heat advisories are still in effect as we go throughout the afternoon as those highs climb well above 100 degrees. Again, a slight chance of a pop-up shower and storm across the areas, especially around Park City and the higher elevations. As you get into the valley areas, mainly staying dry and hot. And then as we go throughout your Wednesday and Thursday, I think it's going to mainly be on the dry side. Looking pretty hot, though, remaining throughout the middle of the work week. And then as we get towards the end of the week, increasing rain chances, and yes, maybe some slightly cooler temperatures. And Leslie, it would be great, because the last time we had temperatures at or below average for highs, you have to go all the way back to, interestingly enough, July the 4th, where we had temperatures that were in the 80s to right around 90 for high temperatures. So that'll feel pretty nice out there, and hopefully we'll get some beneficial rainfall as well with this new pattern. So hopefully today we get through the hottest day of the week, and then things will be improving both temperature-wise and rain chance-wise as we head towards the weekend into next week.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie.
Stay tuned. Coming up, I'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. He'll have a preview of this week's County Council meeting. Later on, Park City and Summit County Librarians Kate Mapp and Dan Compton discussing the visit of author Callie Fajardo-Anstein. She wrote the One Book, One Community selection, Woman of Light. And Director of Summit Land Conservancy Cheryl Fox in with a couple of notes about open space issues and upcoming events. Well, the man proposing to create Summit County's newest town, West Hills, has submitted revised community boundaries to the state for review. KPCW's Connor Thomas has details on who's in and who's out.
On the new map, the would-be town of West Hills is nearly 4,000 acres, which is 600 more than originally proposed. The town still surrounds 248 west of Camas, but its new boundaries, which are at kpcw.org, extend a couple miles farther north. Those could still change if state officials determine the new area isn't densely populated enough. The landowner at the very top of the map, Jim McCaffrey, says it looks piecemeal. Town sponsor Derek Anderson says the new boundaries leave out landowners who previously requested exclusion but didn't meet the criteria set out in state law. In an August 2nd press release, Anderson says, quote, "We kept in the remaining non-objecting landowners and added more parcels in that included landowners who'd requested property inclusion." He says he began incorporation efforts after becoming frustrated with county zoning, which didn't allow him to subdivide his property. After Anderson proposed the new town in April of last year, several landowners opted out, most recently the owners of Fetch Dog Services. That gave him the opportunity to redraw its borders. However, to reach those who wanted in, others were included who didn't ask to be.
I mean, clearly there's a huge energy around there that people do not want this to pass. And I moved my family from Bluffdale up there to kind of get away from the political rhetoric and And a neighbor, in my opinion, is a good neighbor when you want to see him, right?
In other words, landowner Justin Hellander likes the privacy rural life affords him, and he worries that it'll be lost with incorporation. But state law does not allow Hellander and others included for the first time to opt out, according to the Utah Lieutenant Governor's Office. KPCW has asked Anderson for interviews with landowners in favor of incorporation, but he claims those quoted in West Hills' April 2023 announcement have been harassed by neighbors. Three of the first 10 landowners to sign on to incorporation actually live within West Hills' boundaries. No one else except the Castor brothers, who've previously proposed developing hundreds of acres south of 248, have advocated publicly for the town. Anderson and others in favor of incorporation have said they're for, quote, modest new growth. Anderson says there isn't a master plan for development, but he does have to submit growth projections to the state. This time around, the sponsor says he's projecting 80% less residential and commercial density than before. LRB Public Finance Advisors, the consultants who decided Anderson's original proposal was feasible, will use these reduced growth projections to assess feasibility for a second time. If they say West Hills could theoretically raise enough taxes to balance a budget, then another public hearing would be held. After that, Anderson will have to collect signatures to put incorporation on residents' next November ballot. That vote ultimately decides the fate of West Hills. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, the Wasatch County Council meets Wednesday starting at 4 o'clock. And on the phone with a meeting preview, I have County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning.
Good morning.
Wasatch County already accepting applications or appeals to the Board of Equalization. So the assessor's office ready for another season, huh?
Yeah. Tax notices went out just last month, and now applications for appeals to those valuation notices are available to people through September 15th. So if anyone has any concerns about their taxes, and just to reiterate for the process, the assessor's office is trying to get accurate market values for properties. If there's some information that they didn't have or something that they missed, that's what the appeal process is intended to catch. So if anyone has concerns about those values, they can reach to our clerk auditor's office and they can schedule an appeal hearing for them.
Okay, and then residents or property owners would need to have backup materials. I mean, just because they don't like it doesn't mean that it's not the case.
That's true. The intent is to try to get to a market value. And while there may be properties that have changed significantly, the real evaluation is going to be on whether or not those properties represent an accurate market assessment. And again, there are times when maybe the assessor's office doesn't have all the information, or they have made a mistake or an oversight. And those are what the appeal process is intended to correct.
So with all of the new growth in Wasatch County, what does the certified tax rate look like? Is that going down?
I don't have it on hand right now, but yes, generally, as the values go up, our certified tax rate goes down. And because Wasatch County is not proposing a truth in taxation increase, the county's portion of the taxes will decrease on an individual property level. There are two entities in the county that are looking at adjusting their tax rate. That's Heber City and Hideout Town. Those two entities may end up increasing their tax rate above the one that is included in the notices right now.
Yeah, what about the school district? I thought taxes were going up there as well.
I don't believe this year they proposed to hold a truth in taxation hearing.
Okay. I noticed that the county also has what it's calling a residential property value equity map online. What's this, and what does it tell a property owner?
What we're trying to do is increase the level of transparency that people have onto the valuations that our assessor's office puts out. So we actually put this out a few months ago, and it's a tool that people can go on and look at what are properties individually valued at and how does that compare to properties around them. It's a complicated process. I don't know all the ins and outs of the appraisal process, but this is just one attempt for us to be able to try and shed a little bit of light on that complex process. People can identify kind of the components that go into a property's value, which include the value of the land as well as the value of the house, and is based on many variety of factors, including the age of the home and whether it's been updated and square footage and other features that affect the market rate that you might see.
Okay. At last meeting, you had public comment from a resident who said they need help with getting around and High Valley Transit doesn't provide that. I think a county council person told this person that Well, maybe they need to look into paratransit. So does that something that Wasatch County offers?
So we are talking right now with High Valley Transit about programming additions to our transit service beginning January of next year. A few months ago, the Wasatch County Council, or maybe it was only a few weeks, they approved a sales tax adjustment. So this is a sales tax that doesn't apply to gas or groceries, but will generate an additional funds to be able to fund, yes, paratransit. So we don't currently offer paratransit, but the intention is that with additional funding, we would be able to begin to offer this service, cover kind of the current service we have, and then we're gonna be discussing with the county council over our 2025 budgeting process, any other changes to our transit service, which may include changes to the microtransit, bus frequency, and other aspects, including saving for some capital investments related to transit.
So what would a paratransit get you? I mean, would it be a dedicated van that's able to lift wheelchairs?
So Summit County currently already has this available in that portions of High Valley Transit. What it is it's a pre-scheduled service for people with qualified disabilities so that they can have more reliability of pickup and drop-off times, and that they get priority on those. So it may look like a dedicated van, but there are multiple vans that might be able to service that same function. And the real intent is just to make sure that for people who are in those situations and have the highest transportation priority needs, that they get a priority status in it. I think that there are many other members of our community that would benefit from just general improvements to our transit service. But this one will target those most in need.
Okay, and then that sales tax will raise how much money? How much more money will you have to add some new services?
So the sales tax, the county council voted to send some of it to support public safety expenditures, and the remainder is for transit. So 75% of those funds. So we're expecting it to generate about $3.6 million next year in total. 1.2 of that would be, about a quarter of that would be public safety, and the remaining three quarters would be transit oriented. So it will generate a pretty significant amount of funds. And this has been kind of all of our intention since we started with High Valley Transit, is to march towards fully integrating with them and annexing into High Valley Transit so that we can have a seat on their board, which we feel like our contract arrangement right now works well. But our long-term goal has to be fully integrated into High Valley Transit and to be able to offer transit as one of the pieces of the puzzle for how we provide transportation services within Wasatch County while minimizing kind of some of the negative traffic impacts that growth has on our community.
All right. The council's had some long conversations about whether or not to send a unified letter to Utah Department of Transportation about the Heber Valley Corridor. Was that letter ever sent?
So I believe the entities are working on kind of adjustments to that letter that was shared. This was at an interlocal meeting just a few weeks ago. Wasatch County produced a resolution that had provided a statement to UDOT supporting the bypass and conservation in the North Fields several weeks before that. And so the discussions have been around the specifics of the content of the letter and how it should be adjusted and how uniform it should be across all of these entities, and if there should be additional entities, which I believe Charleston has expressed an interest in participating in, and others as well. So I expect there will be more discussion. I think overall the community is expressing a desire to get some progress from UDOT on the bypass process so that we can all have a little bit more confidence about that aspect of our transportation network and how it might be able to impact our community as well.
Yeah, so do you have any updates from UDOT? I mean, have they finished their NEPA process or any meetings set?
To my knowledge, there are not any additional meetings set. We hope to get some progress soon. We think that UDOT might be able to proceed with some of the analysis. And I think it could be as soon as later this year that we will have a draft EIS, which will, I think, necessitate additional meetings with the public to educate them about the analysis that UDOT is conducting and ultimately the final result that they will recommend.
All right. Taking a look at the agenda for tomorrow's meeting, tell me a little bit about the creation of this PID, a public infrastructure district for the Wakara Ridge area.
So we've actually been discussing this PID and others for most of this year. In our last month's meetings, the council expressed their support for proceeding. It's actually two PIDs on our agenda. Wakara is one of the projects. This is out on the east side of Tuhe, close to the border with Summit County, and it's a housing development project. The PID would allow that landowner to be able to raise some money, levy it against those properties, and then that is repaid at title transfer. So prior to anyone owning a property up there that's not the current owner, they would need to pay off that debt.
Yeah, so this is the Wasatch County development. Wakara Ridge is the Wasatch County development that is using a Summit County road to access this development. So what will this PID be used for? I mean, is it to build a paved road of their own into their development?
So it is to pave, I believe it's all of the public infrastructure, and I don't believe that those are the roads. There are public infrastructure related to water and wastewater, and there are a number of features related to those public infrastructure things. So yes, it does help with the infrastructure for this project, and if anything, it helps it complete quicker than it might otherwise. So that construction traffic isn't protracted over a longer time frame.
Mm-hmm. Have we figured out a solution for Wakara Ridge?
I believe that the property owners there have been talking with Summit County on ways to mitigate some of the impacts on that 200 South Old Camas Highway Road. And we also are intending to have meetings with Summit County next week as the Wasatch County Council, to be able to discuss potential solutions to these issues.
All right. And then, as you mentioned, there's going to be a second PID, or public infrastructure development, to be created for the Black Rock Mountain Resort. Now, this seems to be a project that's already built. Why would they need money for infrastructure?
So this one actually includes additional amenities there. So you're right in that the Black Rock Mountain Resort already exists, but there are only portions of it that are completed. What they're working on now is an event center, additional hotel space, and other commercial spaces for restaurants and other amenities that will be ultimately a really significant economic driver for the county. Right now, this resort represents the second largest single source of transient room tax in Wasatch County. And with this expansion, that revenue will only grow. So this one is a little bit more clear cut in that it's a primarily commercial development isolated to a you know, smaller geographic area, and is really an economic pro-con benefit for us that as we authorize the PID, that they're able to proceed and build this project that has that economic impact. It's also helpful to think in the context of infrastructure financing districts, which the county has already received applications for. These are a new entity that the state is authorized through this year's legislative session that basically is a PID, but without any county involvement. And we expect to see many of these going forward because there isn't as many hurdles for approving the process. The PIDs represent an opportunity for the county to have a seat at the table in these same discussions. And why we have entertained these PIDs is because there is this existing other alternative that does not require our input at all.
Yeah, so it sounds like what Black Rock is asking for, I mean, that it's for common space, it's for or commercial space. It's not an individual property owner other than all of them. So who gets tagged with that tax increase?
So the way that PIDs work, and I believe infrastructure financing districts as well, is that 100% of the property owners have to opt in, that you can't forcibly apply these debt levies to anyone. So there are existing residents in the Black Rock Resort, but they are not subject to any of these increases. It's only the new other properties that will be built that are subject to it. So for the Black Rock Resort, there is a property tax levy that's being used to repay these funds. But anyone who purchases those, it's primarily a commercial transaction. So we're not looking at people living in these homes. It's going to be a tenant or something like that that is going to have kind of full information about what their rates are going to be. So really it's the future property owners. It may be the same property owners if they choose to lease that property to someone else. And it will ultimately affect the rental rates that they have. But I believe it will be done in a very transparent way, which is, again, one of the requirements that the county has through our PID process that I believe we felt a little bit more comfortable about being able to say, what does that enhanced disclosure mean? That if they do sell it to someone, how do we ensure that that person makes that decision informed about what those commitments are?
So has the developer run out of money? Is that why they need a PID to finish off the project?
I don't know the individual ins and outs of every project. Generally, development projects borrow money from a variety of sources, regardless of where the project is done or who's financing it. And this is one way in which development projects do generate funds. I think that's why you see a lot of interest from the state at it, because there are more competitive sources in other avenues like bank loans or private equity investments. But by having public infrastructure districts and infrastructure financing districts, they are able to borrow this money through tax-exempt bonds, which has an impact on some of those interest rates and other things like that.
Yeah. Now, with the Black Rock project, again, they have development there that if, in fact, something went wrong, they went belly up, there's something to foreclose on. What's the case then for the Waukara Ridge? They have nothing there other than what? Just the property itself? Is that what is being used as collateral?
Yeah, and that's pretty typical for any development project, that the property that is being developed is used as the collateral for any money borrowed. Again, I'm not a developer. I don't know all the ins and outs of the details that they use, but generally when you borrow money, you have to put something up as collateral for it. So yes, Waukara Ridge, there is, that property is available. But again, on the Black Rock Resort, it's not the existing already built structures to the extent that those are owned by other individuals who are not participating in the PID. So there are portions that are owned by the applicants and there are portions that are not. The ones that are not owned by the applicants are not included and would not be subject to any kind of foreclosure or any other action.
Okay. Real quick, there's a memorandum of understanding for Heber City to contract for animal control services. Isn't animal control a county function?
So in Wasatch County, we actually for many years have partnered with Heber City to provide this service. There are several entities that participate in that. Heber City is the one who employs the staff and has provided the service. What this MOU does is it outlines more clearly the relationship we've already had, and it sets a little bit of a blueprint for some changes that we have been discussing. And I think if you ask some of our long tenured county council members, for many years we've been talking about making changes to this structure. We have not yet enacted any of those changes, but what this MOU will do is basically allow us to continue to operate like we are doing now and sets the framework for if it were to change in the future, this MOU would still be in force.
Okay, Dustin, anything you wanted to mention?
Not this morning.
All right, appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybow. The One Book, One Community book this year is by author Callie Fajardo-Anstein. It's titled Woman of Light. In the studio to tell us more about the book and an upcoming discussion, I have Park City and Summit County librarians Kate Mapp and Dan Compton, and I also have the author on the phone. So good morning to all of you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Do you want to start, Kate, and just tell us why this book was chosen for the One Book Read this year?
Yeah, so every year for the past 20 years, Park City Library and Summit County Library have come together to select a book for the community to read. And as soon as, you know, our event has ended, we're back at the drawing board together coming up with ideas for the coming year. And so we discussed having nonfiction, memoir, fiction, and we wanted to do a fiction book. And we always try to look at the themes that we want to highlight in our community. And so we go through a bunch of different books and contacting people. And I believe Rachel from Camus, the Camus branch, she recommended this book. And she, we all read it and we said, yes, this is an amazing book. It highlights similar themes to our community that we would like to highlight as well. And then also the historical fiction part, component of it is always a favorite for our community. Dan, would you like to mention anything as well?
Well, I was just, talk a little bit about more how that is selected. So it's just basically the public librarians?
There's just a committee of librarians from Summit County and Park City. And like Kate mentioned, we try to kind of switch between nonfiction and fiction. Last year we had done Powder Days by Heather Hansman, and so this year we felt it was appropriate to do fiction again, and we just loved this narrative voice that Callie brings with this novel, and that it's about her and some of her ancestors. We thought it was this beautiful story and wanted to share it with the community.
Okay, and we will be doing that, but let's bring Callie on. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself, Callie, and how you came about to write this book?
Yeah, so my name is Callie, and I'm so happy to be on the air with you all. So Woman of Light is actually my second book. My first book was a collection of short stories, Sabrina and Karina. And when I set out to become a writer in early high school, really, I knew that I wanted to tell a story about my family's migration from southern Colorado, northern New Mexico area, to Denver in the early 1920s and into the 1930s. But I wasn't quite yet up to the task of writing this epic historical saga, so I began with a short story form. But after Sabrina and Karina came out and I was really getting going on writing this novel, the voices were really coming to me in a way that was just, it almost felt magical at times. I was living and teaching at Fort Lewis College in Durango, Colorado, and a lot of the book is set in southern Colorado. And so I was using the landscape and the history there just to inform the work. But then when I was finishing up the sections that are set in Denver, I had moved back to the city and was living right downtown. So the book is really, it's built out of my own experiences. It's built out of my ancestors' experiences. And I'm so excited to share it all with you in Park City.
Yeah. So how is it that you got your ancestors' point of view here? I mean, they were living and they, what, told their own stories?
Sure. So my godmother, who is my cousin, at the time she was still alive, and so she was telling me lots of stories. But I grew up listening to the oral stories in my own family. I come from an incredibly multicultural family. My great-grandfather came to Colorado from the Philippines. My great-grandmother was an indigenous and Chicana woman. And then I have a Jewish maternal grandmother. So I grew up listening to my ancestors, my elders' stories. And my mother is also a story keeper, and her name is Renee Fajardo. And so I kind of grew up sort of second generation as the keeper of stories in my family.
I haven't heard that word Chicano in a long time. It was I grew up in Southern California. We heard it a lot. How defines Chicano?
Chicano is an identity. It's Mexican-American, but it also represents our indigenous roots.
All right. So Woman of Light, who is that?
Woman of Light. So it can be any one of the characters that is a woman of light that you identify in the novel. Luz Lopez, her name means light in Spanish. Luz has the sight, and she has sort of this gift, it's a psychic gift, and she can see back and forth in time into the lives of her ancestors. So while I intended that woman of light would be Luz, it's not necessarily just Luz. It could also be her auntie Maria Josie, who is the matriarch of the family, or her sharp-shooting great-grandmother, Sima Vicia Salazar Smith. But I leave that up to the audience to decide who is the woman of light in the novel, but also in your own life, who is your own woman of light.
And in terms of the book's message, what is it that she wanted to convey to your readers?
You know, I write literary fiction, so I really want the message to be up to the reader. How do you feel after this book? I want feelings to be complicated. I want histories to be complicated. And so the ultimate goal with this novel was just to expose people to good writing, a good story, but also maybe take them along on a history that they maybe do not know as well as what is mainstream history of the American West.
All right. So there are some events associated with this event. One coming up, Dan, next week. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, so next Wednesday, August 14th at 7 p.m. at the Park City Library in the Jim Santee Auditorium. The community can come together and hear from Kali and hear more about the book and do a Q&A, and then a book signing afterwards, and Dolly's Bookstore will be providing books to purchase for that.
Okay. It's free, open to the public. Do people need to register, Kate, or anything?
No registration. Please come. We're always super excited for this final event of the summer and for our One Book Community, One Community events. There is a Friends of the Library reception. So if you are a Friends of the Library member of Park City or Summit County, there is a reception at 6 p.m. And that is a registered event. And you can find out more on our website.
Okay. And tell us, how can people read the book? There's still time.
Yes.
That's what I'm telling myself. Yeah.
Excellent. So on Libby, the Libby is the library online app. Both Summit County and Park City libraries offer this app. And with your library card, you can get Woman of Light available at any time right now up to the event. So after the event, it'll be limited access, but right now anyone can download it.
Okay.
In English and Spanish as well.
All right. Mm-hmm. Was it translated then? Or Collie, did you write it in both languages?
No, I don't speak Spanish.
Okay. All right. What are you working on now, Collie?
I am working on a new novel that is set in the future in the American West. So hopefully you'll hear about that soon.
Okay. All right. Anything else you two wanted to add? No?
Thank you so much. We are so looking forward to your visit, Collie.
Okay.
Awesome. Thank you. I can't wait. See you soon.
Okay. Again, that's next Wednesday, August 14th, 7 p.m. at Jim Santee Auditorium. Kate, Dan, and Collie, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, Park City officials who traveled to the Paris Olympics discussed ideas that they could bring home for the 2034 Winter Games at a joint meeting yesterday. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more on that.
Park City Mayor Nan Worrell, Summit County Council Chair Melina Stevens, and Park City Chamber CEO and President Jennifer Wesselhoff were all in Paris when the International Olympic Committee awarded Utah with hosting the 2034 Winter Games late last month. The trio were also able to experience the Summer Games, which began just days later across Paris. They shared their observations at a joint meeting of the Park City and Summit County Councils Monday morning. Worrell says one of the problems she noticed was a lack of clear communication on how to get around the city.
We were invited to the U.S. Embassy to meet with the ambassador and had pre-cleared our route. When we got there, they said, nope, sorry, we've decided to close this road. So that was not an unusual occurrence while we were there.
Worrell says improving communication around transportation should be a priority as Park City prepares to host several Olympic events in 2034. The mayor says the security presence also stood out. Tens of thousands of armed police were brought into Paris for the Games amid heightened concerns about terrorist attacks.
You never went anywhere without seeing officers armed with automatic weapons, which, you know, coming from a community where we don't see that regularly, it on the one hand, it made you feel safe, but on the other hand, you kind of wondered, why do we have to have this level of security here? So
Wesselhoff with the Park City Chamber says it was clear the Games had an impact on locals.
It was stark, the impacts of tourism to Paris. I mean, there were streets that we had to ourselves. Many of the small businesses were impacted by those closures. Residents were impacted. And I think there's just a lot more work that we can do as a community to mitigate that.
Park City and Summit County are seeking a consultant to help create a 10-year action plan to prepare for 2034. Summit County Council Chair Melina Stevens said final proposals are due at the end of the month.
We have so much time to both prepare and to learn from other communities and both the things that they've done well, the challenges that they've had, perhaps some of the things that have fallen flat or didn't work as well as they had hoped.
The multi-year planning effort will also involve Park City Mountain, Deer Valley Resort, and Utah Olympic Park. Along with preparing for the future, council members expressed interest in looking back at lessons learned when Utah last hosted the Winter Games in 2002. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
In the studio now with an update from Summit Land Conservancy, I have CEO Cheryl Fox. Good morning.
Good morning.
So it looks like another sellout almost for your Blue Sky Bash happening this Friday.
That's right. There's always last-minute cancellations and things, so I don't like to say, well, we're sold out, but we're full. But we do always have space if somebody feels like they would like to come. We encourage them to go ahead and go on the website, or if it gets closer to Friday, give us a call in the office because we'd love to be able to accommodate people if they want to come.
Okay, so this is a fundraiser, your annual fundraiser?
It's absolutely. I'd like to say it is the most fun way to save open space. We are fortunate, this is the eighth year that we've done the Blue Sky Bash. We're fortunate that the ranch, the lodges at Blue Sky host us in their beautiful event arena. It's an incredible opportunity for us to showcase the work that we do a little bit. Hawkwatch International brings some raptors that we can talk to during the cocktail hour. People mix and mingle and really enjoy having an opportunity just to chat with other great people in town and people who, you know, share a love of the open spaces and kind of an understanding for how important they are and how fundamental they are, these open spaces, these natural spaces, to pretty much everything that we enjoy here in Park City.
Yeah, so how much money does it raise for you?
We have a pretty hefty goal this year at $450,000. So we're, this is always the time of the week where I'm thinking, oh, but, you know, we have a lot of great people who've already signed up to come. And like I said, we have a few extra spots, I think, if people are still interested. We have some great auction items. We have a very brief live auction. We are so lucky to have support from some local businesses. So Park City Mountain Resort is donating what we're calling a locals package. So it's 20 lift passes, as well as a social membership to Jackson's Hideaway and some on-mountain dining and things like that. So we think that would be a great package for people who, you know, maybe are having friends coming to town, or maybe that's just the way you want to buy your passes this year. So we're grateful, again, to Park City Mountain Resort, Vail Epic Promise, and Jackson's Hideaway for that. Bill White, the restaurateur in town, puts together what we call the Bill White Adventure Dinner. And this is not something that you can get any other way than through a charity auction, a couple of the charities that Bill supports. Mm-hmm. And it's an amazing experience. Bill drives you in a snowcat up onto the mountain to a couple of beautiful teepees. And in there, you have an incredible dining experience with 12 great friends. And that is always something that's really popular at our live auctions because it's not something that you can really acquire any other way. So we're so grateful to Bill White for being willing to support, again, our work to save local open space by this really tremendous donation.
Okay.
Also, I like to let people know that we will be auctioning off an authentic jackalope head, mounted jackalope head.
Authentic.
Because I believe in jackalopes.
Okay. All right. So how's the money spent? I mean, is it to for operations, or is it to actually go out and buy open space?
Well, this is a great question. So, you know, right now we're 1 year into our Utah Headwaters Initiative and our For the Future Fund. So the funds that we raise at the Blue Sky Bash go to support all of the conservation work that we're doing in the Wasatch Back. So, for example, we have a project out on Democrat Alley in the Camas Valley. We have raised the money from the federal government and from the county's open space bond, but we're $75,000 short. So money from the Blue Sky Bash gets us across the finish line in that project and all the other projects that we do. So I like to say that, yes, I say it over and over again, donations from our members, from individuals, from people at the Blue Sky Bash really makes land conservation happen.
All right. You also have some other events happening, I think even one tonight.
That's right. We do a lot of activities to get people outside and connected with nature. Tonight we have nature bathing that happens at 6 p.m. and it's a stroll off into Round Valley, actually, but it's also very meditative. It's a time to sort of sit still and listen and feel and sense what is, a connection, I think, to nature. All of our events are free, but you do have to sign up on our website because we can't handle 700 people. And also you have to sign a waiver. So please go to wesaveland.org and sign up. So there's nature bathing this evening at 6 p.m. Next week on Wednesday, we will have the final hops hike. As you know, we've been going out every other Wednesday all summer long to watch the hops grow on our various open space parcels around town. And so the final hike will be on August 14th. Those also go out at 6 p.m. And again, sign up on our website. I think the rain yesterday will make those hops happy. Under the light of the full moon on August 19th, we will have a moonshine adventure. We like to do this, go outside and play by the light of the moon. That's always fun. Those happen at about 7 p.m. And then our hops harvest is happening tentatively on August 23rd. That's a Friday. That also will fill up because it's become increasingly popular over the years. So that's where we harvest the hops that we've watched grow all summer long. We pluck the cones off of the bines with a B, like in boy. They're not vines, they're bines. And we put them in a big vat at the top of Main Brewery, and Neil's up there pops them right in the brew vat and makes the wild hops beer out of that, at top of Main. So all of these are fun events coming up. Again, go to the website, wesaveland.org, and sign up if you want to come.
So how long does it take to make the beer? It's not like wine or whiskey or something that needs to sit for a while?
No, it does not need to sit, fortunately, because I think we'd get impatient and drink it anyway. So we harvest at the end of August, and it's usually ready to go in early October.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. All right. Again, wesaveland.org. Let's talk a little bit about some of the open space projects you're working on. Anything getting close?
Yes, we have several getting close. So we've been working on a project in Echo Canyon, which is on both sides of I-80 as you drive out towards Evanston, you know, where the big red cliffs are. And we're this landowner has been incredibly patient. It's such a large parcel that even at, you know, it was just expensive to fund. And so we kept putting in applications and And, you know, we'd hear back from our friends at the Federal Natural Resources Conservation Service that it was the top ranked project in the state of Utah, but the state of Utah wasn't allocated enough money to do it. Well, in 2022, with the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, bipartisan passage, the Farm Bill programs that we use to fund programs like this got a huge influx of money. And so then we were finally, after 5 years of applications, able to fund that project. So we hope to close that in the next few weeks. That would be great. Again, the one I mentioned earlier in the Camas Valley, that has also been funded by the federal government and the county. So we're excited about that. We are working with the county on the Ure parcels as you drive into Camas on 248. We have funding for the north parcels. We call that the North Meadows, about 189 acres. And now we're working on some applications for areas on the south side. We have 6,000 acres set to protect in Morgan County and several other, I think there's projects actually in the Camas Valley as well. So yeah, we're pretty excited. Lots of things going on. Our conservation team is a very, very busy group of people.
Yeah, I read on your website you have secured $76 million from the federal government over the last 20 years.
Over the last 20 years, yeah. You know, in 2012, we had done a couple of, actually I think we did our first conservation easement using federal dollars on a 34-acre parcel in Wanship, in Hoytsville. And, you know, we didn't know how to do it. We were kind of running through things, and we got it done pretty quickly. And everybody afterwards said to me, "We didn't think you could do it, Cheryl." And I said, "I'm glad nobody told me that, because we didn't know any better, and we did it." Anyway, I'm sitting in my office again with the representative from the Federal Natural Resources Conservation Service, and he said to me that the state of Utah was being allocated $3 or $4 million a year to protect open space, which doesn't sound like very much. But they were sending it back to Washington, D.C. because nobody in the state was asking for it. They weren't using it. So it was saving land, I suppose, in California or Connecticut, but not here in Utah. And I thought, well, I pay federal taxes. I think I'd like some of that funding used here to protect open space in, you know, the Wasatch Back. So I sort of made it a personal campaign, and the Summit Land Conservancy has grown in ways to be able to access that money over the years.
So if that was 2012, it's actually, you've $76 million in 12 years then.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Okay. And then...
we have a great team.
And then how's the effort going then with the For the Future campaign?
You know, we have been very successful in terms of federal funding, again, because when we launched the campaign, we didn't really realize the impact of the Inflation Reduction Act and how that was going to impact federal funding. So we had a goal of $15 million in federal funding towards the total overall $100 million goal, and we've blown that out of the water. So that's great. That reduces pressure on some of the other funding sources. But we are still looking for... you know, a lot of support from the community. And I think that's what was exciting for us to launch the For the Future Fund was because, I keep saying it, you know, it's like if you walk into a grocery store and you want to buy a bag of chips and you have, it's a dollar for the bag of chips and you have 90 cents, you don't get your chips. And that's exactly the way the federal funding works. So I just need, we just need that last bit, you know, that pushes us across the finish line. And so I know sometimes people hear these dollar figures and they're so large and they feel like, well, you know, how is my $100 important? Well, your $100 is essential. We don't get the federal dollars without community support.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
Well, I just want to say thank you. Again, we are really grateful for all of our sponsors for the Blue Sky Bash. Again, we do have a couple of spots available, and like I said, there's always some last-minute cancellations, so it's a great party. Drink whiskey, save land.
Okay, Cheryl Fox is the CEO of Summit Land Conservancy. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Well, parking availability and a desire to save money are the top two reasons bus riders choose to use park and ride lots. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more on the results from a recent Park City area transit survey.
Over 1,100 people took Park City and Summit County's park and ride survey this past winter. 36% say they use park and rides sometimes or often, 21% reporting rarely. But when they do use them, riders' top reason is there isn't parking at their destination. That's why Park City staff say if more surface parking in and around town gets redeveloped, the area will need more than 1,000 additional park and ride spots.
We have identified that we would need, I'm going to call medium-sized lots at each of those gateway corridors, both at Kimball Junction as well as on 248, to make sure that we're accommodating future demands.
That's City Transportation Planner Carl Miller presenting the new data to Park City and Summit County Council members on Monday. He says the second highest reason riders used park and rides was to save time, money, or gas. Third was simply a preference for public transit. And survey respondents are more likely to ride than your average person. High Valley Transit Executive Director Caroline Rodriguez reports her organization is approaching 5% ridership. That means about 5% of all people traveling in High Valley's service area are using public transit, numbers on par with a city like Los Angeles, but more than in Salt Lake City. Salt Lake's 2017 Transit Master Plan states 2% of all trips were on public transit. In the dense New York City metro area, 41% of travelers are using public transit. 28% drive and 28% walk. The Park City Area Survey didn't explicitly ask people why they don't use park and rides, some of which are never half full, but it did ask how the lots could be improved. Top concerns were inadequate bus routes or frequency and inconvenient lot locations. Here's transportation planner Alex Roy.
Shelters and restrooms are the top two amenities desired at the park and rides besides more frequent transit service.
The park and ride survey results are still preliminary. Once they are finalized, the transportation planners will use them to make policy recommendations at the next joint meeting of the Park City and Summit County Councils, which hasn't yet been scheduled. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, a Park Meadows homeowner has added an electric fence around fruit trees in their front yard. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports that it is unclear if the fence is legal.
There's a new electric fence along the sidewalk of a single-family home on Little Kate Road in Park Meadows. According to the warning sign posted on the fence, it's meant to keep deer and moose from eating and damaging the fruit trees in the yard. The home is on one of the primary roads in Park Meadows, frequently traveled by pedestrians and cyclists. KPCW learned of the fence after receiving a photo and questions about the legality of the electrified yard addition. The property owner told KPCW their home is not governed by an HOA, and they believe the electric fence is allowed under city code. A Park City municipal spokesperson told KPCW the city is investigating whether the electric fence complies with the land management code. The land management code defines what is allowed to be built on property in Park City. A review of the code by KPCW found no rules for or mentions of electrified fencing. The code requires a building permit for fences higher than 6 feet. However, this electric fence does not reach that height. The owner said they had not been contacted by the city as of Monday evening. They also said they would remove the fence if it was found to be against city code. So far, the city has not made a determination. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
And Art on the Trails returns this month to connect arts, culture, and nature. It's hosted by the Arts Council of Park City and Summit County. The event will feature local and regional performing and visual artists. The public can experience the art through tours starting at the Copper Moose Farm Stand on Old Ranch Road beginning August 24th at 2 o'clock. Tours leave every 20 minutes and take about an hour and a half. After the tours, guests are invited back to the farm stand for food, drinks, and live music until 6 p.m. Registration is recommended. Tickets are $25 for adults and free for kids under 12. A link to register and to reserve your tour is available online at kpcw.org.